Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With the coronavirus pandemic, the climate change crisis, and worldwide political tensions, we're facing an uncertain future. In his new book, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and leading energy expert Daniel Yergin describes how these crises are reshaping the world. How do we prepare for this economy? Who are the losers in the transition? What does the future look like for the Eagle Ford Shale and for West Texas? And Daniel Yergin, welcome to The Source. It's great to have you.
Very pleased to join you. Thank you.
So your book starts off in Texas. You talk about the fracking revolution starting off in Dish, Texas, which originally was named Clark, Texas. They sold the name to the Dish Network. An interesting little town, but that's where you start off your story. Why?
I started there because that was where the first successful hydraulic fracturing of shale occurred in the United States. I went out there to look at the site. It's obviously just a little metal enclosed place now, but it was really there that, you know, this whole idea of the new map about how energy has been refashioned around the world. It started in Texas and what happened with shale. And then, of course, it's when I say the new map, I really mean how energy and geopolitics have become so much intertwined. But it starts, I say that the road begins in Texas.
And the history of it does as well with the Texas Railroad Commission, which was the inspiration for OPEC. And then the development of the shale oil drilling, the fracking and the horizontal drilling, this brought down this made Texas this made the nation basically energy independent in a way.
Well, virtually energy independent. We looked like we were going to be there in February of 2020, and then came coronavirus and the cutbacks in drilling, and you know, and the big setbacks. For the industry and for people working in the industry, but basically still the U.S., you know, we used to think of OPEC versus non-OPEC. Now it's the big three. It's the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, and a big part of that is Texas, and of course it's not only the Permian, but it's what's your next door to, which is the Eagle Ford.
Yeah, we're right on top of the Eagle Ford. If you call it Eagle Ford and not Eagle Ford, that tells you that you're in the know and you're paying attention to what happens down there.
Okay, I'll change. I'll try and get that.
No, yeah, I think you did pretty good on that. But the question is about, well, just looking at our own backyard with the Eagle Ford, what's the sustainability for it? There's been a lot of bad press about capital markets deciding it's just not worth it. Some people have called the Eagle Ford Shale a Ponzi scheme.
Well, I don't think that's it. I think it's really Eagle Ford and Permian and the other fields like the Bakken have been a global game changer, not just a game changer for North America. But, and even before COVID, I was writing this in the new map. Shale needed a second revolution, and that is a revolution in its relationship with investors, who don't want growth for any, who didn't want growth for growth for growth's sake, but wanted to know growth with a return to them. So that existed before this, and now of course COVID is and the turn down in prices has put enormous pressure on it. But the basic resource is there. Companies may go bankrupt, but the rocks don't go bankrupt. And that's going to continue. So, you know, our own expectation is that we'll see, and we've seen a decline. You know, we were 13 million barrels a day at the United States in February. Now we'll, you know, kind of the end of the year will be between 10 and 10.5. And I don't think it'll be till next year that we'll start to see a return. And it will be, going to your point, Dave, it will depend upon also what's happening, which is a changed relationship between the companies and the investors.
Now, Donald Trump was recently in the Permian Basin, making sort of a cheerleading tour. This is right when things were looking pretty rocky with what's happening with oil. I don't know if he was there to put some wind back in the sails of many of his supporters in Midland. But here he is talking about what he wants to see happening, or what he thinks is going to happen with the price of oil.
Well, they're coming back right now. And as you know, we made a big deal with Saudi Arabia and Russia and saving 10 million barrels a day each. And that knocked it out. And now you're back to about $41 a barrel. And we worked hard on it because it was looking bleak about 3 months ago when this pandemic started for the oil and gas. And now it's looking really good. We're here really almost celebrating in a sense. And a lot of people are going to be hired back. Ultimately, they'll all be hired back plus.
So Daniel Yergin, $41 a barrel, which is where West Texas Intermediate crude is today. Is that worth celebrating?
Well, it's, you know, it used to be sort of a kind of in the bad scenario, in the down scenario. Now, you know, given when you had negative prices, you know, prices actually below zero, people were pretty happy to get that. I think between 40 and 50, you know, shale, you know, can steady its legs. But, you know, whether you're pro-Trump or anti-Trump, what happened in April was a demonstration of the new position of the United States, because you basically, that's the big three. You had, basically, it was the United States that stopped this oil war between Russia and Saudi Arabia and brought back and stabilized the price by getting these cutbacks. I'm not sure about the numbers he mentioned, but that's what put a floor under the price. And you know, you would have 2 years ago or 3 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that the U.S. would step in to stabilize the price of oil.
And the oil energy policy is one of the issues that's part of this presidential election. And President Trump has accused Vice President Joe Biden of being anti-fracking, and here's Biden's reaction.
The clean energy strategy, that is a place for the energy workers right here in Western Pennsylvania. I am not banning fracking. Let me say that again. I am not banning fracking, no matter how many times Donald Trump lies about me. This future. The future. That's what this is all about.
Now, not only are you a Pulitzer Prize winning author, you're an advisor to presidents on energy policy. Where do you see where Biden is coming from?
Well, yeah, I've been on the Secretary of Energy Advisory Board under the last four presidents, so I'm a pretty nonpartisan person. I think that there are a lot of pressures on him. Part of the sort of the environmentalists, some of them, you know, ban fracking has become a slogan without really thinking through the repercussions. He has said he would ban new fracking on federal lands, I believe. But I think he's finding a position, and I think, you know, I think what he'll come around to, or is coming around to, is a lot of people work in this industry. Before COVID, it was over 12 million people in one way or another. And secondly, this is a big industry for the United States. It's important. It's a big industry in terms of investment in new factories, over $200 billion, in terms of customers for manufacturing. And I think he will be very aware of the foreign policy implications. So I think if you actually had... I think what they're going to realize, if you had to ban fracking or really severely restricted it, that would be basically be an import more policy. And I don't think he's going to want to go in that direction. But there are a lot of forces that are working on him. But that's the most explicit thing he said so far to kind of clarify it. And I'm sure that some of his supporters were dismayed, and others thought that that was a very sound thing to do.
And that was, he made that statement while he was in Pennsylvania, which is a swing state, very important if he wants to
win, exactly. And also, it's one that has really benefited from this shale revolution, because a lot of sort of poor semi-rural communities and rural communities were getting depopulated, had this whole new source of income. And so there are a lot of jobs. You heard, you know, Dave, you heard, I mean, it's very good you began with him talking about jobs, because I think that's what he's also thinking about.
Right. So we had the shale revolution, and now you write about a possible new revolution. It seems that we're on the cusp of, which is a low carbon energy world revolution. And that's going to basically take the chessboard that we have been working with in terms of what are our geopolitical interests, what's America's foreign interest, what's strategic for us, and then toss it out the window, and it's going to look different. Is that what you're writing?
Well, I'd say timing. I mean, you know, the U.S. gets 80% of its energy today from fossil fuels, and it gets under 4% from wind and solar. So you don't turn a, whatever we are, a $20 trillion economy overnight. But it will. So I think it is an energy transition, but I think it unfolds over decades, and it still requires a lot of technology that's not there. So I think that where we are with oil and gas, these are going to continue to be very important energy sources for a long time, but we're going to move into an increasingly mixed energy system with renewables. And of course, you know, wind has been very important in Texas. Cost of solar has come way down, so it's more competitive. And then you're going to have a, you know, I think if a Biden presidency, you'll have a big policy push to try and push to accelerate it. But I think it's you know, it's just when you look at the scale of it and the numbers, it's not something that happens, you know, in 10 years as some people want. So, you know, I think we also need a lot of new technology. It's one of the things I emphasize in the new map, that we don't really have the technology to do what some people want to do.
The technology is moving faster than many people had anticipated. 10 years ago, if you had told people that solar was going to be as cheap as it is right now, they would have told you were, you know, they wouldn't have taken you seriously.
Right. I think that's right. I think that's why I'd say if there's been a shale revolution, there's also been a solar revolution. A good part of that solar revolution belongs to Chinese manufacturing, and China dominates the solar business. About 70% of the world's solar panels are made in China, another 10% by Chinese companies elsewhere. So that's where you start to get tangled up in the geopolitics between the U.S. and China, where it's, you know, we've seen that on other technologies where, you know, there's like a technology race. And I think you're going to start to see, you know, another one is lithium battery supply chain. The Chinese dominate that too. So there's a whole geopolitical side to this that kind of people have not focused on much, to realize, well, what are the supply chains? What do you actually need to add all these capacities? So that's what's going to make it more complicated.
Tomorrow is battery day. Elon Musk is going to make a presentation to Tesla stockholders talking about a new generation of batteries that he has, the removal of cobalt, higher energy density. Some people are saying we're finally going to get to $100 per kilowatt hour for batteries for cars. They say that's going to be a game changer. Things are moving fast. I mean, your book is incredibly up to date. I can't believe how up to date your book is, but it's still moving too fast.
Well, it's moving fast. I mean, I finished the book. You know, normally you finish a book 9 months in advance. I finished the new map second week of July, and they took it away from me. I mean, they took it away from me. But I think you're right. I have a great chapter about Tesla in the book. I've spent a great source with the chief technology officer of Tesla, who talked about how difficult it was and how amazing it was. So I think one thing we've learned, whether it's with Tesla or with SpaceX, is don't underestimate Elon Musk. I have this great photo spread in the book, and I have this picture of Thomas Edison standing next to his car in like 1900, his electric car, which did not gain traction, and Elon Musk in almost the same pose next to his car. And you sort of think, in a way, is Elon Musk the reincarnation of Thomas Edison? And he's made it happen.
Yeah, but his vehicle is called Tesla, which was the rival for Thomas Edison.
Yes.
And then also, yes. Edison designed that car with the help of Ford. And Tesla could be taking on Ford. They anticipate there's going to be a challenge there. New map is definitely going to involve a lot of these, to struggle between these major corporations and deciding what is the new center of the planet. You know, are we going to move away from Saudi Arabia? And what is Russia going to be doing? Can it sustain itself? 40 to 50% of its budget, national budget, comes from oil and natural gas. As these prices come down, as there's less need, what's going to happen to the world and the stability and U.S. foreign policy? You can call in with a question or comment. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us a question at thesource@tpr.org. We continue our conversation with Daniel Yergin when we come back from the break. You're listening to The Source. Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're joined by Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Former books as The Quest, The Prize, Shattered Peace. These are books that you got to read if you want to understand how the world has been shaped by oil and energy. His new book is The New Map. So what's the biggest difference between the new map and the old map, Daniel?
Well, I think one big difference is, of course, the transformation in the role of the United States. I think a second big difference is, if I think about when I wrote The Prize, China hardly figured in the story. Now China is central to the story of energy and indeed the future of the 21st century. And I think the third thing is what we've been talking about around the new technologies around renewables. Their commerciality kind of getting to scale, and we live in a world that is a post-Paris climate agreement world. So I think those are some of the big changes that I would think about. So there's a sense, in a way, in so many different ways of disruption, and you know, the map or the new map tries to be a guide through this. This new world that we're in, and of course, COVID is just the latest disruption and a massive one.
So the United States has gone to war over oil, basically, in the past. Do you agree with that? Is that a reach?
Let me think. I think that, World War II, of course, the U.S., 6 out of every 7 barrels of oil used in the war came from the United States. I think there was an oil war within the war because oil was so important to the conduct of the war. The Gulf War, I think, was about the stability of the Persian Gulf and whether Saddam Hussein would dominate it, including its oil. I think the Iraq War, I don't think was about oil. And if you look at the companies that are in Iraq today, most of them are not American.
The original name that they're going to give the Gulf War was the Operation Iraqi Independence, I think, and then Liberation, and then they realized that spelled oil, and they had to change that. So today, though, it seems like oil will be less important to our economy, that we will not have to be put in a position to, these will not be as strategically important for the country?
Well, I think it's changed. I think the sense of vulnerability that the United States had, president after president after president after president said we want energy independence, and no one ever thought we could get there. But I think that you had that last year, about 13 months ago, you had this drone attack by Iran on this huge oil facility in Saudi Arabia called Abqaiq. And, if that had happened 4 years ago, you would have had panic on the world market. You had panic for about 18 hours. And I think a big difference is that what this change in the U.S. position has meant for the sense of energy security. So in answer to your question, I think that there is a confidence about supply that wasn't there before, because before it was always, can we be cut off?
And that stress of can we be cut off, that seemed to have added to the price of oil. When we had markets that were running at full capacity, there's little slack in the market, then you could ask for more for oil, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the prices would shoot up and you would get panicky prices. And, when we had oil crises before, people would start hoarding oil and all of that would stockpiling it. And motorists would put more, instead of keeping their tanks 1/4 full, would keep it 3/4 full. And all of that would drive up the price. Now, kind of, it's just a shrug.
Yeah, even when we have hurricanes in the Gulf now, when they would have to get people off the platforms and shut down refineries, that used to cause a price shock, but not today.
Yeah, I mean, as you describe it, David, it is quite remarkable that we have this called the security blanket that is a big part of which is the change in the energy position in the United States. So it's just there isn't a sense. The issue is, there's a lot of oil around and there's oil that's, countries like Iran is not even being produced right now because of sanctions. So there's even more oil around. And of course, the shale producers, they belong to this category called short cycle, which means that, you can drill a well, when within a few months, as opposed to those big projects that take years and billions of dollars.
So we had the situation in April, a stranded asset, as they call it, where we had all this oil, but no one to buy it. And it went to, at one time, a negative $37 a barrel. And that's that's what gives people nightmares.
Yeah, and that was, you know, and it, you know, wanted to know how interconnected our world was. Some of the biggest losers on that, you know, people would never think this, were retail Chinese investors in U.S. energy futures. I mean, that's the kind of world we live in. But when that number came, it was like that was, you know, it just won't be forgotten because it was so, you know, just so stunning and was a real message, although it was a fluke of the futures market, was a message about the deep distress in the industry at that time when I describe it was like an economic dark age had come over our economy.
So your old map was also a reflection of the Cold War. And with a new map, are we going to get a new Cold War? And will it be the United States, China?
Well, Dave, you mentioned my first book, which was called Shattered Peace, which was about the origins of the Soviet-American Cold War. And I never expected to be thinking or writing about new Cold Wars. And yet, as I was writing the new map, more and more I began to think we're headed in that direction with China, which is very different than the Soviet-American Cold War, which was based upon nuclear weapons. He and the Soviet Union was hardly a factor in the global economy. China, along with the U.S., is so integrated in the world economy and with each other that you have to scratch your head and say, well, how does this work, this new era of competition? But in the last, you know, there are a few things, as you were talking about before I came on about the Supreme Court, deeply divided partisan country. One thing you see that unites Democrats and Republicans is this view that the United States now has a very competitive relationship with China, which, you know, if you'd gone back 3 or 4 years, even, you know, and this started to become the view before Trump became president, but it's certainly become much sharper now. And I think the Chinese see this as a great power rivalry, too. I looked at the defense documents of both the Chinese and the Americans, and they talk about strategic rivals, great power competition. This was not language we had 5 years ago, and you kind of see it intensifying. So I think it is of concern in how to manage it. Who's ever president, whether it's Trump or Biden and who are their successors, this will not be a short-term thing. Managing this will be one of the great sort of geopolitical challenges for the United States.
But Russia, Putin, he came to power. Basically, he rode this wave of insurging in oil demand. And Russia, they have oil. And he was able to ride that and use that to solidify his power base. And I'm wondering now if there is a couple of years, 5 years of who knows, but of $40-ish a barrel oil, will that reverse bring him down? Because 40 to 50% of that nation's budget comes from the sale of oil or natural gas.
Well, it will put pressure on it. I mean, I think the Russian budget, unlike the Saudi budget, the Russians have said they'd like about $50 a barrel oil because they want to maintain the market and they don't want to encourage competition. 40 puts pressure on Russia. And one of the factors in this price war and this whole thing that went on in earlier this year was the Russians, or at least some of the Russians, not wanting to give up market share to shale. And I have personal experience of that. I have an anecdote in the book. I didn't say it was me, but, you know, because I don't use the I in the book. But, you know, being shouted at by Putin when in front of he was on a panel with Chancellor Merkel, and I was given the opportunity to ask the first question. So I was asking him exactly your question, actually, about reforming your economy, reducing dependence. By accident, I mentioned shale, and he just started shouting at me, you know, and you could see that, you know, he saw shale as a geopolitical issue. He saw shale as strengthening the position of the United States vis-a-vis Russia, and he didn't want shale. He didn't want shale development in Europe. So I think that he has an economy that oil is very important to it. And, you know, I think $40 puts pressure on it. $50, I think the Russians think, you know, that's not bad for them as long as there's decent economic growth. But their larger question is, when are they going to, you know, open up their economy and diversify it?
So when Putin sees things like oil in terms of economic warfare. He uses that to pressure his neighbors, including Germany. Did he see shale oil as economic warfare against him?
I think that's a very good question. I think, you know, in a form he does. He sees it as giving, well, first he sees, you know, this whole battle over this pipeline going from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Corridor, Nord Stream 2. He sees that, he's, you know, in a very cynical way, he sees it that the U.S. wants to sell more LNG, liquefied natural gas in Europe and push out Russian gas. I think he sees it that way. And then he sees shale as a sort of support or adjunct to a U.S. foreign policy, giving the U.S. flexibility that it didn't have in that era that we talked about before, when the United States was highly dependent on imported oil. The U.S. can deal with Venezuela very differently today than in the old days when we really needed Venezuelan oil.
And now we don't. And Venezuela is on the ropes. You know, this is the country that has the most oil reserves anywhere, even more than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's coming close to producing zero oil. And it's a tragedy about how terribly managed that country has been to be in this situation.
We're talking with Daniel Yergin, his new book, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. If you have a question for him about energy, the markets, where is this going, about the jobs, Eagle Ford Shale, the climate is a big part of this book as well. We got to get to that part, and what's happening with COVID, how that's reshaping the economy, and how that has pushed oil prices down. Call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Back in 1 minute.
We're in the grip of a pandemic that shows no signs of abating. But what do we know about this novel coronavirus? I'm Bonnie Petrie. Every week on Petri Dish, we explore the latest science of the virus and what this pandemic is doing to our lives. Listen and subscribe to the Petri Dish podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Daniel Yergin. His book is The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. So you really had to hang on to the book as long as you could before a publisher took it out of your hands to update it with COVID. And COVID has just turned everything upside down and inside out. And did anyone ever think that this could happen, that this was something they needed to plan for?
I think it was interesting. I've done a number of sort of conversations with CEOs of major companies, oil companies, other companies, and there's only one company I know of that actually had a pandemic in their strategy. That's because the CEO had been in Asia during their planning, rather, during the SARS crisis in Asia in the early years of this century. But, you know, Bill Gates, I quote Bill Gates in 2015 warning of something like this, and there were others. I cite a scenario that was actually done in 2004 that just imagined a major pandemic in 2020, and it's kind of eerily true what it describes. So a few people saw it, but, you know, I asked myself, Dave, why did most people just forget it? You know, partly, you know, the great influenza, Spanish influenza of 1918, kind of the history was somewhat suppressed because it was during wartime. And then, you know, I went back and looked at SARS, and, you know, SARS, which was the pandemic in Asia, a total of 8,000 people got sick and less than 800 passed away. You know, and so I think that when this started, kind of people thought about it as, well, SARS, it's over there, it's containable, and just was not prepared for this highly transmissible coronavirus and how easily it would pass from person to person in this modern age.
I think a lot of people had faith in the government and the CDC and scientists that we had deployed to intercept this before it reached this point. It had worked before, and then we had the failure under the Trump administration for a number of reasons. But, you know, there was faith that this was going to never get to this point. And here we are. And this is not only going to changing the world we live now, but it will change the future even after we get through COVID. You think that this will be a permanent way of people will change the way that they work?
Yeah, I think that this was one of the casualties of the breakdown between the U.S. and China, because we actually helped the Chinese set up their CDC, and we had monitoring in China, and that all fell apart, and we pulled people out. So we didn't have the early warning system that we'd had before, as I understand. Yes, this will change things a lot. I mean, you know, number one, obviously, I asked the question whether for many people will the office of the future be at home? What does that do to commuting? If people are not commuting, what does that do to supply, you know, to demand for fuels and so forth? On the other hand, we see in large cities people being reluctant to use public transport and an upsurge in the sales of used cars. So I think there'll be major changes. I think it's too soon when we're still in the middle of it to really generalize. You know, one key question is when we come out of this, are we going to have a weak economy because of all the wounds that were left? And, you know, it's just tragic to see what's happened to small businesses and boarded up and just people who didn't have the resources to last. Or will we have a kind of, like in China now, seems to be having a kind of a growth spurt in reaction to it. And, you know, we'll know that in it. Presumably, if we have the vaccine by this time next year, we'll have some widely dispersed, we'll have some sense of that. But this has turned out to be a longer haul than anybody, I think, most people would have imagined when things shut down in mid-March.
Also in your book is the specter of climate change and the demand that we create a viable, sustainable, robust, low-carbon or no-carbon economy, and getting to that as quickly as possible while also keeping in mind that, you know, we can't have blackouts. We have to be able to turn on the lights and have all the good things that we enjoy. And the puzzle piece that we're missing is mass energy storage. And where do you see that?
Well, we did this study for Bill Gates Foundation's and other. I did it with former Energy Secretary Ernie Moniz, and certainly identified as large-scale battery storage as you know, kind of a huge priority. And we'll, as you suggest, we'll hear from Elon Musk tomorrow on that subject. Everybody knows that this is a big target. But you know what I found really interesting as I was researching this? There are 62 private sector projects, companies, initiatives on a new generation of nuclear power going on in the United States too. So, you know, we need a lot of different technologies to address this, but battery storage would change it. You know, I always like to surprise people. I say, what state do you think has the most wind? And of course, they say California. I say, no, it's Texas. And if Texas was an independent country, I think you would be the country with the fifth largest wind supply in the world.
Yeah, and if Texas were an independent country, its economy would be about the size of Russia's.
Right.
Which I don't know which if that's good or bad.
Better organized. Yeah, I mean, part of the thing, you know, I had this question in the book. Should I, you know, when you try and say, well, what can you compare the Russian economy? Here's this superpower. It's a great power again. How big is its economy? Well, it's basically its economy is somewhere between Spain and Italy. And, you know, Spain was a superpower in like the 16th century, but it hasn't been since then.
Yeah. So I wonder if this is one thing I'm concerned about. It's like the Russian economic model of the oligarchs and crony capitalism. And it seems like, you know, Putin is not really in favor of, and he wants to be an economic power, but he doesn't want to give it up that he has for full-fledged economic capitalism.
No, I think it is, it's a kind of combination of state capitalism, as you said, and very concentrated in a relatively few hands. And I think it's, you know, it's tough you know, small business is a great source of economic growth and in any economy. And it's hard there just because you need, you know, you need the protection of courts, you need sanctity of contracts, and all those things don't exist. Partly, you know, they can do well because, you know, you do have those oil and gas revenues flowing into the country.
Right. So you point out we got Russia, we got China, we got the United States. So Russia has that type of economy and suppression on innovation. China has state-run and it has its advantages, but the United States has innovation. We've got people who are willing to redesign and recreate and come up with new solutions. And what's going to be more valuable in the future?
Well, I think the answer is in your question. It is this incredible ecosystem, if we can tell it that, or culture that we have in the United States that goes from basic research and science and 17 national laboratories through research to big companies to startups to people taking a chance. And, you know, when Tesla's the classic case. I mean, the idea you were going to start a new automobile company, there hadn't been a new auto company in the U.S. since 1925, and you're going to do it in Silicon Valley, pretty laughable. Well, look, it's ended up setting the agenda. I have a quote in the book from former top guy at General Motors that, you know, we didn't think it was possible, and then we saw this company in California do it, and we realized it is possible. Now you have Mary Barra, the president of CEO of General Motors, saying that GM is going to go electric, and a lot of the other automobile companies are saying the same thing. They just, of course, have to bring the motorists, the customers, along with them. But I think we'll see there, you know, pretty good incentives now to buy an electric vehicle, and I suspect we'll see more if Biden is president.
Right. So, but even if Biden is not president, we don't know what's going to happen. And we know what Trump wants to do, but, you know, there's a lot of people around him that are pretty smart. Are we still going to be able to compete in the world one way or the other?
Well, you'd be surprised, but even under the Trump administration, the basic science budget, research budget for energy in the U.S. Department of Energy, $6.5 billion a year, far larger than any other country. And if you look at electric utilities, what they're doing in this country, I was just at the CEO conference, they're all moving towards low carbon, towards you know, incorporating more renewables, partly for economic reasons, partly because of society wants it, partly because of regulators, but they're all, and partly because investors want it, but they're all moving. So that's going to happen who's ever president. A lot of things are going to happen. It doesn't matter who's president, they're going to continue to happen. And that's the decarbonization of electric power will continue to progress.
Sure. Donald Trump ran on the promise of bringing back coal. Did coal come back?
Coal has not come back in the United States, not at all. I mean, natural gas, which was sort of almost a stepchild in electric generation, is now about 35% of our generation. And coal, which was 50%, I don't know, it's way down to maybe around 20% now.
Right. So the point is, market forces are market forces.
Exactly. And, you know, gas is basically, I mean, there are regulatory forces that are very powerful too, but gas is out competing coal for the most part right now because of the shale revolution.
And also the desire for cleaner energy. Gas is not 100% clean, but it's cleaner than coal.
Yes, absolutely.
And so what would you do to prepare the nation, and I have about a minute left here, to advise whoever who's going to lead the country in the next 4 years, what are the main things or the single thing that they should do to prepare for the new map?
I think there are two things. One is continue to move towards new technologies, renewables along that path, but at the same time, ensure that we maintain this industry that we have now, oil and gas, which is a really big asset. And I use this metaphorically, other countries would kill to have the position that we have in energy.
What should investors pay attention to?
They should pay attention to how companies adapt to the sort of ESG, the targets around how's your strategy fit with the Paris Agreement, which seems to be the big question now.
So the Paris Agreement's not going to go away depending on the election?
No. It's the benchmark for people making their choices, evaluating energy choices. And so it's there who's ever president.
All right, Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, leading energy expert. His new book, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. It was great talking with you. I really enjoyed it.
Well, great to be on with you. Thank you.
All right, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.